For a moment, we step back 60 years to Martin Luther King's speech at the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C. Maybe a quarter of a million people gathered there, and it was broadcast, too. So who knows how many folks heard the famous I Have a Dream speech. Author Jonathan Eig's book, King Alive, talks about that, and he tells the whole story of Martin Luther King's life. Part of that famous speech went like this.
50 years ago, a great American in whose symbolic shadow we stand today signed the Emancipation Proclamation. This momentous decree came as a great beacon light of hope to millions of Negro slaves who had been seared in the flames of withering injustice. But 100 years later, the Negro still is not free. 100 years later, the life of the Negro is still sadly crippled by the manacles of segregation and the chains of discrimination.
Usually when you hear cuts from that speech, you hear I Have a Dream. We thought we'd listen in to some other part. In fact, as I understand it, and Jonathan, thanks for joining us. Jonathan Eig, again, his book is King Alive. As I understand it, he kind of went off script when he started a riff on I Have a Dream. Is that correct?
Yes, John, that is correct. He had written the speech out the night before. He got to his hotel very late, 2 a.m. he began working on the speech and did not include any of the I Have a Dream speech part of the speech. He improvised that entirely. So, you know, he was focused mostly in the first half of the speech on issues of economic injustice, police brutality. It was really a wake-up call for America, and he decided, you know, just in the spur of the moment, to add the inspirational, you know, more hopeful part about his dream.
Mahalia Jackson or someone said, talk about your dream, Martin, and that's kind of where he went off on that. Was that kind of boilerplate for him, though? Was that a common maybe bit of a speech that he was giving those days?
It wasn't one of his absolute favorite. It was something he'd used a couple of times before. He had delivered the I Have a Dream speech just weeks earlier, actually, in Detroit at Cobo Hall, in what at that time had been the largest gathering of black protesters in American history. And so he knew it worked well. And it wasn't Mahalia's idea, actually. King started in on I Have a Dream, and then Mahalia shouted, that's right, tell him about the dream, as if to offer encouragement, because she'd heard it before, and she knew it was a winner.
I wonder what decided, how were he and she realizing they had a moment here to make history? I wonder if they knew that that was going to be the resonant part of the speech.
Well, I think King was such a gifted communicator. And, you know, they told him that he had 8 minutes to speak. And he just decided, I'm Martin Luther King Jr. I'm going to go on a little longer. And I'm going to take this crowd to church now. That's really what he did. The first half of the speech is a speech for an auditorium. It's a lecture. And the I Have a Dream part is a sermon, and that's what he did best. And the emotional part of that speech is really what we remember today because he was so good at that.
Yeah. I don't have your book in front of me, but as I recall, didn't you say there were about 8 speakers and they sort of lined them up and they put him last because nobody wanted to follow Martin Luther King?
Yeah, that's right. Nobody would ever want to follow King. He was so good at what he did. And on almost every occasion, you know, gave a memorable speech. He loved being in front of an audience. And yeah, there were a lot of other speakers that day, but we are hard-pressed to remember any of the other speeches. King's is the only one that most Americans can recall, and that's for good reason. It really changed the whole dynamic of that event. And I think it left the American people all over the country, as you said, you know, millions of people watching this on TV with a sense that times were changing, that this really was a pivotal moment in American history, that we could be a better country and we could, you know, fulfill the promise of the Declaration that had so far been, you know, sort of an empty promise for a lot of Americans.
Yeah. You wrote in your book, I would say without judgment, about his infidelities and his plagiarism. You simply tell us those stories. Was that speech plagiarized somewhat?
Yeah, I think that the speech is really the moment that people remember. But it was important for me to remind people that there was a complex life behind the man who gave that speech. That it doesn't come out of nowhere. That, you know, King was a human being just like the rest of us, and for him to give that kind of an inspirational speech in spite of all the difficulties he'd seen, everything his family had lived through, trying to get us to live up to the words of the Constitution and the Bible. You know, King knew he wasn't perfect, and he didn't have to be. He was telling people that they don't have to be perfect either to march and to make the world a better place.
Yeah, I don't mean to dwell on this point, but I do recall you noting instances from his academic career through his preaching years and political years that he would sometimes appropriate things other people said without attribution. And what I'm wondering today was how much of that was just sloppy. You didn't have cut and paste back then. It was lazy. Or was he, in fact, trying to represent something as his own that was not?
Well, he was definitely a plagiarist, if you want to call it that. But he came from a tradition of preachers where you borrowed all the time without any apology. If you heard a good sermon, you did it the next week in church, and it was a tribute as well as an imitation. And I think most preachers were very comfortable with that. And I think that's why, you know, King never really thought of it as plagiarism and never really tried to hide it. Because he thought, if something's good, like I Have a Dream, that's Langston Hughes. He took it from Langston Hughes, and he didn't apologize about it. I think he would have been more than happy to have other people borrow his work too.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you're putting it in those terms, because I do think there's that contextualizes it a little bit. If you take us back to that era, that culture, that community, if that's the way they rolled, that's different than how we would score it today. Today, that paper gets thrown out of college.
Yeah, and it should have gotten thrown out of college. His doctoral dissertation should have been caught, and he should have been made to go back and do it over, or he should have been, you know, given an F until he got it right. But when it came to giving sermons, that's another story, and nobody was going to give him an F for borrowing in his sermons.
What was the reaction from the crowd that day? Can you just talk a little bit about that day and the mall?
It was extraordinary. You know, 70% of Americans were opposed to the March on Washington, and JFK was opposed to the March on Washington. They feared that it would result in violence, that there would be attacks, there'd be counter-protests, and it came off beautifully. And on national television, after seeing water cannons in Birmingham earlier that year, after seeing riots break out in American cities, people saw this vision of harmony, and they saw black and white people together holding hands and singing, and it was a beautiful, inspiring moment. Even John F. Kennedy, when he met King later that day, was in awe. Most Americans had not seen or heard King give a sermon like that, and they had never seen a scene with so many people together in loving kindness, trying to make a better America, not shouting, not yelling, not angry, but really trying to come together to make a better place. And I think most of America was really moved by that. Of course, there was a backlash from some people who were not ready for racial progress, and we saw that backlash, you know, a couple weeks later with the bombing of the church in Birmingham, unfortunately. But the vast majority, the millions of Americans watching on TV, the vast majority, it was a beautiful scene.
Was there a backlash that it wasn't aggressive enough, that his movement wasn't angry enough?
No, mostly the backlash came from white racists who didn't want to see integration. Later, you know, King would face criticism for not moving fast enough, for not being radical enough, and some, you know, younger black leaders wanted to push him to be more aggressive, but not really in 63. He wasn't facing too much of that kind of backlash yet.
That's interesting to me, because so many protests, especially around civil rights these days, are marked by violence. There wasn't a lot of that either that day or within the movement at that time?
No, there was none of it that day. And there were a few Nazi party protesters. They were pretty much fenced in and kept away from the main affair. But the event in D.C. 60 years ago today came off beautifully. And the you know, any more radical black groups like, you know, the Nation of Islam or just different groups that have different approaches were not really very active that day. And I think you know, the vast, vast majority of civil rights activists were on board with the march. And, you know, you had even, you know, members of SNCC, you know, who were on the program. And I think there was a great sense of unity that day.
Hmm. In the Tribune today, there is a piece by the counsel at the Chicago Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights. He says one of the promises of democracy of which King spoke that day was securing and protecting the voting rights of every American. And then they say in Illinois, that fight continues to re-enfranchise nearly 30,000 individuals, 55% of whom are black, who cannot vote due to their incarceration. Disenfranchisement by incarceration is a Jim Crow relic. Can you talk a little bit about what the things were that Martin Luther, what were his planks? What were the things he was asking for that day?
When we started out, and you started out with that clip from his the early part of his speech, and he made very clear in the early part of that speech that this was a march for jobs and freedom, for economic equality. And he talked about police brutality. He talked about voting rights. He said that black Americans were never going to be satisfied until the justice was applied equally. And I think what you're talking about is an example of how justice is still not being applied equally. All over the country, really, we're seeing attempts made to restrict voters, in particular black voters, because and using, you know, less obvious ways to do it now. And the voting opportunities for felons, convicted felons, is one example. Anything that can be done in some places to try to limit the black voter registration is happening. So the fight definitely still carries on. The things that King talked about are still problems today. Economic inequality, segregation, we're still wrestling with many of these same issues.
This is 60 years ago, which is a long time ago, but it's not even a full lifetime ago. And every now and then when I'm confronted with some description of racial inequality and some people say, look, we've done enough. Some of them are on the Supreme Court, mind you, and other people say, no, we still have a long way to go. I'm just reminded that this happened within the lifetime of many of the people listening to you and me right now, some of these inequalities. It's maybe not enough to say be patient, but you do have to sometimes step back and realize how recently and how ingrained some of these racist policies or attitudes were.
Yeah, that's right. And King said many times the best time for justice is now, and that we have to keep pushing. And yes, we've made enormous progress since 1963. But we have a long way to go, and that's what King was talking about when he said that the arc of history bends toward justice. But sometimes you can't see that bend because it's happening so slowly.
Yeah, right. Did he foresee his own death?
A lot of people said he did. They thought that he was depressed in the last years of his life, and he was depressed. He was frustrated that he wasn't being heard, that he seemed to be losing effectiveness, losing popularity, and he began pushing for things like you know, guaranteed jobs, guaranteed income. He began opposing the Vietnam War, and people were frustrated by that. They wanted him to stick to the South and stick to voting rights, the things that he was known for. So some people felt like he was depressed and felt like that he was, you know, that people were turning on him. And at the same time, he'd been stabbed in the chest. His home had been bombed. The FBI was harassing him and basically had declared him an enemy of the country. So he was not irrational in thinking that, you know, it was possible that he might be assassinated.
Yeah. One last question. We're talking to Jonathan Eich. His book is about Martin Luther King, King of Life. Came out this year, recommended everywhere, and sat on the New York Times bestseller list, too. He was a singular character, wasn't he? That is, that man at that point in time. Have we had anybody like that since?
Oh, man. You know, it's very hard when a certain person comes along at just the right moment. King was exactly made for that moment in history. He was a black Southern man starting out in Montgomery, Alabama, who could speak to audiences everywhere. His voice just echoed and his arguments were very hard to refute. It was very hard to tune him out. And that made him really special, especially at that time when he came along. We've had many, many, you know, courageous leaders in all kinds of areas of our life since then. We have people speaking out on global warming. We have people speaking out for gay rights. You know, we have had no shortage of great leaders, but I think MLK still stands apart just because he lived such a short time and accomplished so much. You know, we need to remember that he was only 39 when he was assassinated.
Yeah. I guess 39. Wow. Okay, Jonathan, thanks again. Let's find another occasion to visit soon. Do you get tired when people say, what are you going to write next?
No, I just get frustrated that I haven't figured it out yet, but I will soon.
Well, I'm sure it'll be terrific when you do. Thanks, Jonathan.
Thank you, John.